6.4. Wily, irresponsible Noah Marks, who had given his word not to show the manuscript of Mulligan's travels to anyone but his father and stepmother, broke that word by lending his copy to 24-year-old Billy Best, a prose writer and Columbia dropout who earned his living as the superintendent of a four-story walk-up building on East 89th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenues, a working-class subsection of Yorkville known as the Rhinelander District. 2 years earlier, Billy had founded a small publishing house of mimeographed books called Gizmo Press, a non-commercial, anti-commercial operation that had released about a dozen works so far, among them volumes of poetry by Ann Wexler, Lewis Tarkowski, and Tulsa-born Ron Pearson, who had given the author of Mulligan's Travels a copy of John Cage's Silence back in October. In those days before the advent of cheap offset printing, Mimea was the only form of book and magazine production available to the young, penniless writers of New York. And far from being a sign of obscurity or a one-way path to terminal neglect, having your work published in Mimeo by a house such as Gizmo Press was considered a badge of honor. The print runs averaged around 200 copies. The titles and illustrations on the cardboard covers were drawn in black and white by Billy's downtown artist friends, most often by Serge Grayman or Bo Janard, fluid and inventive draftsmen whose cover work helped set the tone of mid-60s graphic design, the look of the moment, which was bold and unadorned, and tried not to take itself too seriously. And even if there was something ragged and improvisational about books printed on 8.5 by 11-inch typing paper, the contents were unsmudged and readable, as clear as any offset or letterpress book. Billy's wife, Joanna, prepared the stencils on her large office-sized Remington and single-spaced pica characters with unjustified right-hand margins when the work was in prose, and then the stencils were fed into the mimeograph machine in Billy's workroom and run off on both the recto and verso of each page, collated by a group of friends and volunteers, and put together with saddle-stitch binding, staples. Most of the copies were given away for free. That is, sent off or handed to fellow writers and artists, and the remaining 50 or so were distributed to the handful of Manhattan booksellers who believed in the next generation of American newness. And for a young person to walk into the Gotham Bookmart or the 8th Street Bookshop and see his Mimeo book among the recent offerings of poetry and fiction was to understand that he was beginning to exist as a writer. Ferguson should have been furious with his cousin for having gone behind his back and shown the book to someone without permission. But he wasn't. Noah had run into Billy Best at a Lower East Side gathering in mid-May, 1 month after Ferguson had finished the manuscript, and 1 week after his third and final visit to Dr. Broiler. Noah had started talking to Billy about his cousin's work. Billy had expressed an interest in seeing it, and by the last week in May, Noah was on the telephone with Ferguson, letting the cat out of the bag. Sorry, he said. He knew he wasn't supposed to have shown the manuscript around, but he'd gone ahead and done it anyway. And now that Billy had been floored by Mulligan's travels and wanted to publish it, Ferguson wasn't going to be dumb enough to try to prevent that from happening, was he? No, Ferguson said. He was all for it. And then he thanked Noah for his help, which launched them into a conversation that lasted for about half an hour. And after they hung up, Ferguson understood that it made no difference if he thought the book should be burned and forgotten. He needed the book now because his life was over, and publishing it would perhaps be a way to trick himself into thinking he still had a future, even if no more Fergusons would ever be a part of that future. And how fitting it was that he had chosen to publish his work under the name of a murdered man, his paternal grandfather Isaac, felled by 2 bullets in a Chicago leather goods warehouse in 1923. The man who was supposed to have been Rockefeller, but wound up being Ferguson, father of a father who had vanished from his son's life, and grandfather of a grandson who would never live to become a father himself. Billy Best became a good friend and a devoted publisher of Ferguson's early books, but Noah Marks was the best man there was, and whenever Ferguson tried to imagine who he would have been without him, his mind would shut down and refuse to give an answer. Nimble Joanna managed to convert the 131 double-spaced pages of the manuscript into 59 single-spaced pages by eliminating the blanks that preceded each chapter head of Mulligan's 24 journeys and starting the new journeys on the same pages as the old, which reduced the better part of a year's work to 30 sheets of paper, thin enough to be stapled together without difficulty. Instead of using Bo Janard or Serge Grayman to design the cover, Ferguson asked Billy if Howard Small could take a shot at it, and because Howard produced such a good drawing, Mulligan, sitting at a desk and writing one of his reports in a room crammed with artifacts and souvenirs from his adventures, he too became a part of the Gizmo family, and went on contributing covers and illustrations until the press folded in 1970. 59 pages on 30 sheets of paper, which meant that the last page of the book was empty. Billy asked Ferguson if he would like to write a biographical note about himself to fill that emptiness, and after thinking about it for close to a week, Ferguson submitted the following two sentences. 19-year-old Isaac Ferguson can often be found wandering the streets of New York. He lives elsewhere. No more Evie. No more visits to the Half House in East Orange after the last visit to Dr. Broiler's office in Princeton. Ferguson could no longer bring himself to face her. He had let her down and destroyed her hopes, and he didn't have the courage to look her in the eyes and tell her he would never be the phantom father of the illusory baby she had invented to hold them together in some future world when circumstances would at last have driven them apart. What a tangled business it was. How badly they had both deceived themselves, and now that the words of a doctor had put an end to their deluded aspirations, Ferguson picked up the phone and announced that end as any other coward would have done it, not even daring to sit down in her presence and talk it out, and perhaps come to the conclusion that it wasn't the worst tragedy in the world and that they could go on in spite of it. Evie was shocked by his callousness. "Too bad and all that," she said, "and I really do feel sorry for you, but what does it have to do with us?" "Everything," he said. "No, you're wrong," she replied. "It makes no difference, and if you don't understand what I'm saying to you now, then you're not the person I thought you were." Ferguson was fighting back tears on the other end of the line. "We weren't going to last much longer," Evie continued, "and maybe I was a fool to drag you into this pregnancy talk, but damn it, Archie, I've given you everything I have, and at least you owe me the decency of saying goodbye to me in person." "I can't," Ferguson said. "If I came to see you, I'd break down and cry, and I don't want you to see me cry." "Would that be so terrible?" "It would be for me, worse than anything." "Grow up, Archie. Try acting like a man." "I am trying. Not hard enough. I'll try harder, I promise. The important thing is that I'll never stop loving you." "You already have. You're so sick of us, you don't even want to look at me anymore." "That's not true." "Stop lying, please. And while you're at it, Archie, please, from the bottom of my heart, go fuck yourself, too." On Wednesday, May 25th, 2 weeks after that hellish conversation with Evie, Noah called with the news that Billy Best wanted to publish Mulligan's Travels. Ferguson and Billy talked on the 25th and arranged to meet each other on Saturday, the 28th, and consequently Ferguson did not remain in Princeton that weekend to study for finals with Howard, as he had planned, but went to New York on Friday as usual. But having told his grandfather he would not be coming that weekend, and then having forgotten to tell his grandfather that in fact he would be coming, he caught his grandfather by surprise, and the surprise he caused his grandfather was only 1/100th as big as the surprise he caused himself. As far as he knew, he was the only other person who had a key to the apartment. Now that he and Evie were quits, Ferguson had come back twice for solo weekend stays in his grandfather's spare bedroom. And on both of those Friday afternoons, he had let himself into a quiet apartment, walking in to discover his grandfather sitting on the sofa in the living room, reading the sports pages of the Post. But this time, when he slipped the key into the lock and opened the door, he heard voices coming from the living room. Perhaps two or three voices, he couldn't tell how many, but none of them his grandfather's voice. And once he was inside, the first thing he heard distinctly was a man's voice saying, "That's right, Al. Put your cock in her now." And then another man's voice was saying, "And just when he does that, Georgia, remember to take hold of Ed's hard-on and put it in your mouth." There was a short hallway between the front door and the entrance to the living room. And as Ferguson tiptoed past the closed door of the spare bedroom to his right, and then past the narrow galley kitchen that was also to his right, he came to the end of the wall and was standing at the edge of the living room. And what he saw in there was his grandfather sitting next to a man operating a 16-millimeter camera, three light stands burning brightly at what must have been 1,000 watts each, another man in the middle of the room with a clipboard under his arm, and three naked people on the sofa, a woman and two men, a dead-eyed woman of about 30 with bleach blonde hair, large breasts, and a flaccid, protruding stomach, and two nearly indistinguishable men, perhaps twins, chunky, hairy beasts with tumescent cocks and woolly butts, carrying out the instructions of the director and the cameraman. Ferguson's grandfather was smiling. That was the most jarring element in the whole sordid picture, the smile on his grandfather's face as the old man watched the woman and the two men sucking and fucking on the sofa. The director was the first one who saw him, a small young punk in his mid-20s, wearing jeans and a gray sweatshirt, the one who had been talking through the action because they weren't recording sound, which no doubt would be added in later as a series of histrionic moans and groans during the post-production of this cheapest of cheap cinematic endeavors. And when the young director spotted Ferguson standing in the hall just outside the living room, he said, "Who the hell are you?" "No," Ferguson said, "who the hell are you, and what do you think you're doing?" "Archie," his grandfather yelled out as the smile vanished and turned into a look of fear, "you told me you weren't coming this weekend." "Well, I changed my plans," Ferguson said, "and now I think these people should get their asses out of this apartment." "Calm down, sport," the director said. "Mr. Adler is our producer. He's the one who invited us here, and we're not leaving until we finish shooting the film." "I'm sorry," Ferguson said, as he walked over to the naked people on the couch, "but the fun is over for today. Put on your clothes and get out." As he reached for the woman's hand to pull her up and get her on her way, the director rushed toward him from behind and wrapped his arms around Ferguson's torso, pinning his arms against his sides. One of the naked twins then jumped up from the sofa and threw his right fist into Ferguson's stomach, a painful jab that so incensed the embattled Ferguson that he broke free of the small director and tossed him to the floor. The woman said, "For crying out loud, you assholes, stop this shit and let's get on with it." Before it could develop into a genuine brawl, Ferguson's grandfather stepped in and said to the director, "Too bad, Adam, but I think we should call it a day. This boy is my grandson, and I need to have a word with him. Call me tomorrow, and we'll figure out the next step." Within 10 minutes, the director, the cameraman, and the three actors were gone. Ferguson and his grandfather were in the kitchen by then, sitting across from each other at opposite ends of the table, and the moment Ferguson heard the door bang shut, he said, "You stupid old man, I'm so disgusted with you. I don't ever want to see you again." His grandfather wiped his eyes with a handkerchief and looked down at the table. "The girls mustn't know," he said, meaning his two daughters. "If they ever found out, it would kill them." "You mean it would kill you," his grandson said. "Don't say a word, Archie. Promise me that." Ferguson, who had never even considered telling his mother or Aunt Mildred what he had seen that day, refused to make any promises, even though he knew he would never tell anyone. "I'm so lonely," his grandfather said. "All I wanted was a little fun." "Some fun. Throwing your money into a third-rate porn flick. What's wrong with you, anyway?" "It's harmless. No one gets hurt. Everyone has a good time. What's wrong with that?" "If you need to ask that question, then you're beyond hope." "You're so hard, Archie. How did you ever get to be so hard?" "Not hard, just shocked and a little sick to my stomach." "They can't ever know. As long as you promise not to tell them, I'll do anything you want." "Just stop, that's all. Shut down the film and never do it again." "Look, Archie, what if I gave you some money? Would that help? I know you don't want to stay here with me anymore, but if you had some money, you could go out and find yourself another apartment in New York. You'd like that, wouldn't you?" "Are you trying to bribe me?" "Call it what you want, but if I gave you $5,000, $6,000, no, let's say $10,000, that would help you out a lot, wouldn't it? You could rent your own little apartment somewhere and spend the summer writing instead of working at that job you told me about. What was it again? Junk removal. Junk removal. What a waste of time and energy. But I don't want your money. Of course you do. Everyone wants money. Everyone needs money. Think of it as a gift. As a bribe, you mean? No, as a gift. Ferguson took the money. He accepted his grandfather's offer with a clear conscience, because in point of fact it wasn't a bribe, but a gift, since he never would have said a word to his mother or Aunt Mildred anyway. And if his grandfather was so flush that he could afford to write a check for $10,000, better that the money should go to his grandson than to finance another woe-begone fuck film. But what a jolt it had been to walk in on that bizarre scene, and how crazy and perverse his grandfather was becoming in his old age. Widowed and alone with no restraints on him anymore, free to indulge himself in any debauched whim that caught his fancy, and what further embarrassment would be coming tomorrow. Ferguson still loved his grandfather, but he had lost all respect for him, and perhaps even despised him now, enough never to want to stay in the apartment again, and yet not half as much as he despised his father, who was altogether gone from his life now, gone for reasons that largely had to do with money. And there he was gladly accepting money from his grandfather and shaking his hand to thank him for it. Another complicated business, another daunting fork in the road, and just as Laszlo Flute had found out in right, left, or straight ahead, whatever choice he made was bound to be the wrong one. Nevertheless, $10,000 was a monumental sum in 1966, a bundle beyond imagining. With small apartments in rundown New York neighborhoods, renting for less than $100 a month, sometimes for as little as 50 or 60, Ferguson would be able to find something for his escapes from Princeton and still have enough to live on during the summers without having to work at summer jobs. It wasn't that he had been dreading the prospect of hauling junk in the interim between his freshman and sophomore years. He knew from his high school summers with Arnie Frazier and Richard Brinkerstaff that menial work had numerous satisfactions to offer, and that one could learn valuable lessons about life in the process. But there were many years of that sort of work still in front of him, and the chance to take a pause from heavy lifting during his time in college was an unanticipated lucky break. All because he had walked in on his grandfather and caught him with his pants down. A revolting discovery, yes, but how not to laugh about it at the same time? And he, who would have kept his lips sealed until the last breath in his body had exited his lungs, was rolling in a pile of hush money. If you couldn't laugh at that, there was something wrong with you, something not quite right in your head. Ferguson went out for a dinner of pizza and beer with Noah in the village, then spent the night on the floor of his cousin's NYU dorm room, and the next day, when he traveled uptown to meet Billy Best, more startling things kept on happening to him. Billy was so relaxed and genial, so effusive in his praise of Ferguson's book, which he called the weirdest fucking shit he had read in a long time, that the young author again silently thanked his cousin for having put him in touch with this person, who resembled no other person he had ever known. Billy was both a working-class roughneck and a sophisticated avant-garde writer, born and raised on the block where he still lived, super of his building because he had inherited the job from his father, a street-savvy native son who watched over the neighborhood like a sheriff in a Hollywood Western, but also the author of a complex, hallucinatory novel in progress set during the French and Indian Wars called Crushed Heads. Ferguson adored the title. And to listen to his publisher's melodious New York Irish-American tenor voice made him feel as if the very bricks of the buildings on East 89th Street were vibrating with words. On top of that, Billy's pregnant wife, Joanna, spoke with the same voice he did, down-to-earth and welcoming, a legal secretary by day, typist, stencil cutter for Gizmo Press by night. She was the one who would be working on Ferguson's book as her baby grew inside her, bringing Ferguson's baby to life, even if it was only a book, and he would never have anything to do with the production of real babies. And when Joanna and Billy asked him to stay for dinner on that first Saturday night of their new friendship, Ferguson mentioned that he would be looking for an apartment in the coming days, just as soon as the check in his wallet had cleared. And because Billy and Joanna knew everything that went on in their small neighborhood, they tipped him off about an apartment 6 doors down the block, a one-room studio that went on the market just days after their first meal together, and that was how Ferguson wound up renting his third-floor digs on East 89th Street for $77.50 a month. His first year at Princeton was coming to an end. Howard would be taking off for the summer to work on his aunt and uncle's dairy farm in southern Vermont. And although Ferguson had been invited to join him in that bucolic venture, the half-destroyed ex-lover of Evie Monroe, who had simultaneously become the half-resurrected author of the soon-to-be-published Mulligan's Travels, had already backed out of his junk removal job and was planning to spend the summer working on his next writing project, The Scarlet Notebook. Amy would be down in the city for those months as well, working as an editorial assistant for a trade magazine called Nurse's Digest, and so would her new boyfriend, Luther Bond, who had found a spot filling in for someone in the coming events department at the Village Voice. Celia Fetterman, on the other hand, would be far away, profiting from the reward her parents had given her for graduating early from high school, a two-month trek through Europe with her 20-year-old cousin Emily. As predicted, Bruce the boyfriend, a.k.a. the human buffer zone, was a thing of the past. Celia promised to write Ferguson exactly 24 letters, which she instructed him to keep in a special box labeled Fetterman's Travels. Noah would be gone too, unexpectedly and at the last minute gone, up to northern Massachusetts to take part in the Williamstown Theater Festival, which he had tried out for on a whim because the girl he was pursuing had wanted to try out. But while she was turned down without a single callback, Noah wasn't. And now he would be acting in two different plays over the summer, All My Sons and Waiting for Godot. And the plan to do a film version of Soulmates was put on the shelf again. Ferguson was relieved. More than that, he was happy for Noah, who had always been the best actor on stage whenever he had seen him perform, which must have been 7 or 8 times over the years. And however much Noah wanted to become a filmmaker, Ferguson was convinced he had the stuff to become a top-of-the-line actor, not just in comedies, which he already excelled at, but in dramas too, although perhaps not in tragedies, at least not the 50-ton classics in which men plucked out their eyes and mothers boiled their children, and Fortinbras entered as the curtain eased down slowly on a mass of bloody corpses. Ferguson also felt that Noah could have made people piss in their pants if he ever decided to do stand-up, but each time he had suggested it to him, Noah had frowned and said, "Not for me." But he was wrong, Ferguson thought, dead wrong to resist. And one evening he had even gone to the trouble of sitting down and trying to write some jokes for Noah, just to get him started. But jokes were hard, so hard they were almost impossible. And except for some of the tennis matches he had done with Howard earlier in the year, he seemed to have no talent for them. Writing droll sentences in a story was one thing, but coming up with unforgettable punch-out zingers required a different sort of brain from the one that had been planted in Ferguson's skull. Amy had been linked to Luther Bond since the beginning of May. Now it was June, and according to Ferguson's most recent telephone conversation with her, his aggressive, battling stepsister still hadn't found the nerve to tell her father or stepmother about the new man in her life. That disappointed Ferguson, who had always admired Amy for her guts, even though he had sometimes wanted to strangle her as well. And the only reason he could come up with to account for her hesitation was not that her boyfriend happened to be black, but that he was militantly black, a black power person who stood even farther to the left than Amy, a large, menacing figure in a black leather jacket with a black beret sitting atop his afro, just the sort of man to frighten Amy's gentle, live-and-let-live father into a month-long panic attack. Then the couple came down from Boston and moved into their summer sublet on Morningside Heights. That same evening, they met Ferguson for a drink at the West End Bar, and when Ferguson shook Luther Bond's hand for the first time, the cartoon he had drawn in his head exploded into 1,000 worthless fragments. Yes, Luther Bond was black, and yes, he had the firm handshake of a physically strong person, and yes, there was a stubborn sort of determination in his eyes. But when those eyes looked into Ferguson's eyes, Ferguson understood that they were looking not at an enemy, but at a potential friend, someone he was earnestly hoping he would like. And if Luther wasn't the belligerent, hate-filled terrorist of the cartoon, Then what was wrong with Amy, and why in the world had she not told her father about him? He would have to talk to her about that in private and do what he could to pound some sense into her. But for now, he had to focus on Mr. Bond himself in order to figure out what kind of person he was. Not a big person, that much was clear, but an average person of 5'9 or so, roughly the same height as Amy. And if hair was any indication of a person's political beliefs, then Luther's modest afro suggested he was on the left, but not the far left, as opposed to the large afros worn by the black as beautiful people. And as for his face, well, it was awfully handsome, Ferguson thought. So good-looking as to verge on cute, if such an adjective could be applied to men. And as Ferguson studied that face, he understood why Amy had been attracted to Luther and was still attracted to him after 6 weeks of talk and steady sex. But putting aside those superficial things for a moment, the extraneous details of how tall or how short, and hair lengths and cuteness quotients, the more important thing Ferguson was discovering about Luther was that he had a sharp sense of humor, something Ferguson valued in people because he was so bereft of verbal wit himself, which was why he gravitated toward people like Noah Marks and Howard Small and Richard Brinkerstaff, all of whom could talk circles around him. And when Luther told Ferguson that his roommate at Brandeis had been a fellow freshman named Timothy Sawyer, in other words, Tim Sawyer, Ferguson laughed, and then he asked Luther if Tim bore any resemblance to Tom. But Luther said no. He reminded him more of that other character in the Merk Twang book, Hick Fun. That was funny. Merk Twang and Hick Fun were genuinely funny. The same kinds of two-in-one things Howard would blurt out in his inspired moments. And the fact that Amy laughed made it even funnier. No doubt much funnier. Because the volume of her laughter meant she had been caught off balance, which proved she had never heard Luther say those things before. Which in turn proved that Luther hadn't come up with his distorted versions of Mark Twain and Huck Finn last month or last year, and had not been going around repeating them to his friends. No, he had invented them on the spot, right there at the West End bar. And Ferguson appreciated a mind that was quick enough and clever enough to deliver a pair of such delicious puns, or, as he wanted to say out loud but didn't, such pungent puns. Instead, he laughed along with his snorting stepsister, and then asked Mr. Bond if he could buy him another beer. Ferguson had already been given some information about Luther's background and the odd path he had traveled from the central ward of Newark to Brandeis University in New England. Things Amy had mentioned to him on the phone, such as the 7 years Luther had spent at the Newark Academy, one of the top private schools in the area, not paid for by Luther's cab driver father or his housemaid mother, but by his mother's employers, Sid and Edna Waxman, a wealthy couple from South Orange, whose only son had been killed in the Battle of the Bulge, an uncommon duo of grieving souls who had fallen in love with Luther when he was a little boy. And now that Luther had won his scholarship to Brandeis, the Waxmans were doing the same thing for his younger brother, Septimus, Seppi. And how about them apples, Amy had said to Ferguson on the phone. A rich Jewish family and a struggling black family united forever in the disunited states of America. Ha! Ferguson was therefore up on the fact that Amy's boyfriend had attended the Newark Academy when the three of them sat down for drinks at the West End. And before long, the conversation came around to Newark itself. Then Newark and basketball, a sport that Luther and Ferguson had both played in high school. And because the words Newark and basketball had unexpectedly occurred in the same sentence, Ferguson brought up the Newark gym, where he had played in the triple overtime game when he was 14. And the moment he said the words triple overtime, Luther leaned forward, made a wordless, indecipherable noise somewhere in the back of his throat and said, "I was there." "So you remember what happened," Ferguson said. "I'll never forget it." "Were you playing in the game?" "No, sitting in the stands, waiting for your game to be over so mine could begin." "You saw the half-court shot. The longest swish on record at the buzzer." "And afterward?" "Yes, that too, as if it was yesterday. Kids were pouring out of the stands, and I got punched hard as I was running out of the gym, punched so hard that it went on hurting for hours. It was probably me." "You?" "I punched someone, but I don't know who it was. All white people look the same, right? I was the only person on my team who got punched, it had to be me, and if it was me, it had to be you. Amy said, the once stable Earth is wobbling out of orbit. Tidal waves are rushing across the seven seas. Volcanoes are wiping out cities. Or am I just imagining things? Ferguson smiled briefly at Amy and then turned back to Luther. Why did you do it? He asked. I don't know. I didn't know then, and I still can't explain it now. It shook me up, Ferguson said. Not the punch, but the reason for the punch. The madness in the gym, the hatred. It built up slowly, but by the third tie score it was starting to get ugly in there. Then came the swish, and everyone snapped. Until that morning, I was your average American numbskull boy, a person who believes in progress and the search for a better tomorrow. We'd cured polio, hadn't we? Racism was going to be next. The civil rights movement was the magic pill that was going to turn America into a colorblind society. After that punch, after your punch, I suddenly got a lot smarter about a whole lot of things. I'm so smart now, I can't think about the future without feeling sick. You changed my life, Luther. For what it's worth, Luther said, that punch changed me too. The feelings of the crowd got inside me that morning, and the anger of the crowd became my anger. I wasn't thinking for myself anymore. I was letting the crowd think for me. So I lost control when the crowd lost control, and I ran down onto the court and did that dumb thing. Never again, I said to myself. From now on, I'm the one who's in charge of me. Christ, white people were sending me to school, weren't they? What did I have against white people? Just wait, Amy said. You've been lucky so far. I know, Luther replied. Plan A, work to become a lawyer like Thurgood Marshall. Work to become the first black mayor of Newark. Work to become the first black senator from New Jersey. But if that doesn't turn out, there's always Plan B. Buy myself a machine gun and follow the words of Malcolm. By any means necessary. It's never too late, right? Let's hope not, Ferguson said, as he raised his glass and nodded in assent. Luther laughed. I like this stepbrother of yours, he said to Amy. He tickles my funny bone and knows how to take a punch. His arm might have hurt that day, but what about my hand? I thought my knuckles were broken. The Scarlet Notebook was going to be difficult, far and away the most challenging work he had ever attempted, and Ferguson had serious doubts about whether he could pull it off. A book about a book that one could read and also write in, a book that one could enter as if it were a three-dimensional physical space, a book that was the world and yet of the mind, a conundrum, a fraught landscape filled with beauties and dangers, and little by little a story would begin to develop inside it that would thrust the fictitious author F into a confrontation with the darkest elements of himself. A dream book. A book about the immediate realities in front of F's nose. An impossible book that could not be written and would surely devolve into a chaos of random, unconnected shards, a pile of meaninglessness. Why attempted to do such a thing? Why not simply invent another story and tell it as any other writer would? Because Ferguson wanted to do something different. Because Ferguson was no longer interested in telling mere stories. Because Ferguson wanted to test himself against the unknown and see if he could survive the struggle. First entry. In the Scarlet Notebook, there are all the words that have yet to be spoken, and all the years of my life before I bought the Scarlet Notebook. Second entry. The Scarlet Notebook is not imaginary. It is a real notebook, no less real than the pen in my hand or the shirt on my back, and it is lying in front of me on my desk. I bought it 3 days ago in a stationery store on Lexington Avenue in New York City. There were many other notebooks for sale in the store. Blue notebooks, green notebooks, yellow notebooks, brown notebooks. But when I caught sight of the red one, I heard it call out to me and speak my name. The red was so red that the color was in fact scarlet, for it burned as brightly as the A on Hester Prynne's frock. The pages inside the Scarlet Notebook are, of course, white, and there are many of them, more pages than a person could possibly count in the hours between dawn and dusk on a long midsummer day. Fourth entry. When I open the Scarlet Notebook, I see the window I am looking through in my mind. I see the city on the other side of the window. I see an old woman walking her dog, and I hear the baseball game playing on the radio in the apartment next door. Two balls, two strikes, two men out. Here comes the pitch. Seventh entry. When I turn the pages of the Scarlet Notebook, I often see things I thought I had forgotten, and suddenly I find myself back in the past. I remember old telephone numbers of vanished friends. I remember the dress my mother was wearing on the day I graduated from elementary school. I remember the date of the signing of the Magna Carta. I even remember the first Scarlet Notebook I ever bought. That was in Maplewood, New Jersey, many years ago. Ninth entry. In the Scarlet Notebook, there are Cardinals, red-winged blackbirds, and robins. There are the Boston Red Sox and the Cincinnati Red Stockings. There are roses, tulips, and poppies. There is a photograph of Sitting Bull. There is the beard of Eric the Red. There are left-wing political tracts, boiled beets, and hunks of raw steak. There is fire. There is blood. Included also are the red and the black, the Red Scare, and the mask of the Red Death. This is only a partial list. 12th entry. There are days when a person who owns a Scarlet Notebook must do nothing but read it. On other days, it is necessary for him to write in it. This can be troublesome, and on some mornings when I sit down to work, I am not certain which activity is the correct one to pursue. It seems to depend on which page you have come to at that moment, but as the pages are unnumbered, it is difficult to know in advance. That explains why I have spent so many fruitless hours staring at blank pages. I feel I am supposed to find an image there, but when nothing materializes after my efforts, I am often gripped by panic. One episode was so demoralizing to me that I was afraid I would lose my mind. I called my friend W., who also owns a Scarlet Notebook, and told him how desperate I was. "Those are the risks of having a Scarlet Notebook," he said. "Either you give in to your despair and wait for it to pass, or you burn your Scarlet Notebook and forget you ever had it." W. might have a point, but I could never do that. No matter how much pain it causes me, no matter how lost I sometimes feel, I could never live without my Scarlet Notebook. 14th entry. On the right-hand pages of the Scarlet Notebook, a soothing, crepuscular light appears at various moments during the day, a light similar to the one that falls on wheat and barley fields at dusk in late summer, but more glowing somehow, more ethereal, more restful to the eye, whereas the left-hand pages give off a light that makes one think of a cold afternoon in winter. 17th entry. The startling discovery last week that it is possible to enter the Scarlet Notebook, or rather that the notebook is an instrument for entering imagined spaces so vivid and tangible that they take on the appearance of reality. It is not just a collection of pages for reading and writing words then, it is a locus solus, a microscopic slit in the universe that can expand to allow a person through if he presses the Scarlet Notebook against his face and breathes in the smells of the paper with his eyes closed. My friend W. has warned me how dangerous it can be to go off on these impromptu excursions, but now that I have made my discovery, how can I resist the urge to slide into those other spaces every now and then? I pack a light lunch, throw some things into a small overnight bag, a sweater, a collapsible umbrella, a compass, and then telephone W. to let him know I'm about to take off. He worries about me constantly, I'm afraid, but W. is much older than I am. He turned 70 on his last birthday, and perhaps he has lost his feel for adventure. "Good luck," he says to me, "you moron," and then I laugh into the phone and hang up. Until now, I have not been gone for more than 2 or 3 hours at a stretch. 20th entry. In the Scarlet Notebook, I am happy to report, there is a violent curse against each and every person who has ever wronged me. 23rd entry. Not everything in the Scarlet Notebook is what it seems to be. The New York that dwells inside it, for example, does not always correspond to the New York of my waking life. It has happened to me that while walking down East 89th Street and turning the corner onto what I was expecting to be 2nd Avenue, I have found myself on Central Park South near Columbus Circle. Perhaps this is because I know those streets more intimately than any others in the city, having just settled into an apartment on East 89th Street at the beginning of the summer, and having gone to Central Park South hundreds of times since the beginning of my life to visit my grandparents, whose apartment building on West 58th Street also has an entrance on Central Park South. This geographical synapse would suggest that the Scarlet Notebook is a highly personal instrument for each person who owns one, and that no two Scarlet Notebooks are alike, even if their covers all look the same. Memories are not continuous. They jump around from place to place and vault over large swaths of time, with many gaps in between. And because of what my stepbrother calls this quantum effect, the multiple and often contradictory stories to be found in the Scarlet Notebook do not form a continuous narrative. Rather, they tend to unfold as dreams do, which is to say, with a logic that is not always readily apparent. 25th Entry. On every page of the Scarlet Notebook, there is my desk and everything else in the room where I am sitting now. Although I have often been tempted to take the Scarlet Notebook with me on my walks through the city, I have not yet found the courage to remove it from my desk. On the other hand, when I go off into the Scarlet Notebook itself, I always seem to have the Scarlet Notebook with me. So began Ferguson's second swim across the lake, his Walden Pond of solitary word work and 7 to 10 hours of desk time per day. It would turn into a long and messy splash, with frequent submersions and ever more exhausted arms and legs. But Ferguson had an inborn talent for jumping into deep and perilous waters when no lifeguards were around, and given that such a book had never been written or even dreamed of by anyone before him, Ferguson had to teach himself how to do what he was doing in the process of doing it. As seemed to be the case with everything he wrote now, he discarded more material than he kept, whittling down the 365 entries he composed between early June and mid-September 1966 to 174, which filled 111 double-spaced typewritten pages in the ultimate draft, making his second novella-length book slightly shorter than the first. And when it was boiled down further on Gizmo's single-space stencils, the text came to 54 pages, an even number that absolved Ferguson of the onerous responsibility of having to write another autobiographical note about himself. He enjoyed living in his small hush money apartment, and all through his first summer there in 1966, as Joanna worked on the typing of Mulligan's Travels, and Ferguson sweated out the pages of the Scarlet Notebook, he continued to think about the $10,000 and how slyly and underhandedly his grandfather had explained the gift to his daughter Rose, calling her at home the very next day, which was the same day Ferguson had met Billy and Joanna Best for the first time, to tell her he had started his own informal equivalent of the Rockefeller Foundation, i.e., the Adler Foundation for the Promotion of the Arts, and had just bestowed a $10,000 award on his grandson to encourage his progress as a writer. What a colossal mound of bullshit, Ferguson thought. And yet how interesting that a man who had been shamed into tears and had written out a check to cover up his guilt could turn around the next day and start bragging about what he had done. Crazy, stupid old man. But when Ferguson talked to his mother from Princeton the following Monday, he had to suppress his laughter as she reported what her father had said to her. The incredible phoniness of it all, the show-off self-aggrandizement of his unparalleled generosity. And when his mother said, "Just think, Archie, first the Walt Whitman scholarship, and now this amazing gift from your grandfather," Ferguson replied, I know, I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth," consciously repeating the words Lou Gehrig had spoken at Yankee Stadium after he found out he was dying from the disease that would eventually be named after him. "Sitting pretty," Ferguson's mother said. Yes, that was it. Sitting pretty, and what a grand and beautiful world it was if you didn't stop to look at it too closely. A mattress on the floor, a desk and a chair found on a nearby sidewalk and hauled up to the room with Billy's help, some pots and pans bought for nickels and dimes at a local Goodwill mission store, sheets, towels, and bedding donated by his mother and Dan as housewarming gifts, and a second typewriter bought second-hand at Osner's typewriter shop on Amsterdam Avenue to avoid having to lug a machine from Princeton to New York and then back to Princeton every Friday and Sunday. an Olympia manufactured in West Germany circa 1960 with an even finer and faster touch than his dependable, deeply loved Smith Corona. Frequent dinners with the bests, frequent dinners with Amy and Luther, occasional get-togethers with Ron Pearson and his wife Peg, and solo expeditions for early dinners at the ideal lunch counter on East 86th Street, the eating hall with a sign over the door that read, "Serving German Food Since 1932, a significant date that established no connection with what happened in Germany the following year. And how Ferguson liked to chow down on those heavy, lump-in-the-stomach dishes, Königsberger Klopse and Wiener Schnitzel, and hear the large, muscular waitress behind the counter shout into the kitchen with her thick accent, "Wann Schnitzel!" which never failed to evoke memories of Dan and Gil's dead father, that other crazy grandfather in the tribe, Jim and Amy's cantankerous crackpot, Opa. The luckiest man on the face of the earth also had the good fortune to meet Mary Donahue that summer, Joanna's 21-year-old younger sister, who was spending those months with the bests and working in an office before heading back to Ann Arbor for her senior year. And because the plump, jovial, sex-mad Mary took a shine to Ferguson, she often came to his apartment at night and crawled into bed with him, which helped diminish the constant longing he still felt for Evie and turn his thoughts from the vile thing he had done to her by cutting it off without a proper goodbye. Mary's soft and abundant flesh, a good place to drown in and forget who he was, to throw off the burden of being himself. And the sex was good because it was simple and transitory, sex without strings, without delusions, without hope for anything more lasting than it was. Ferguson's initial plan was to barge in and settle the Amy Luther problem himself, to go behind their backs in the same way Noah had done with his manuscript, and call his mother to tell her what was going on and ask how she thought Dan would react to the news. Then he re-examined that approach and concluded he didn't have the right to deceive his stepsister or act without her consent. So one evening in the middle of June, as Ferguson, Bond, and Schneiderman sat in the West End inhaling and imbibing another round of cigarettes and beers, the son of Rose asked the stepdaughter of Rose if she would allow him to speak to his mother on her behalf in order to get this nonsense over with. Before Amy could respond, Luther leaned forward and said, "Thanks, Archie." And a moment later, Amy said more or less the same thing. "Thank you, Arch." Ferguson called his mother the next morning, and when he told her why he was calling, his mother laughed. "We already know about this," she said. "You know? How can you possibly know?" "From the Waxmans, and also from Jim." "Jim?" "Yes, Jim." "And how does Jim feel about it?" "He doesn't care, or rather he does care because he likes Luther so much." "And what about Dan? A bit shocked at first, I would say, but I think he's over it now. I mean, Amy and Luther aren't planning to get married, are they?" "I have no idea. Marriage would be tough, tough for both of them, a tough, tough road if they ever decided to do that, but also tough for Luther's parents, who are none too pleased about this little romance to begin with." "You've talked to the Bonds?" "No, but Edna Waxman says the Bonds are worried about their son. They think he's been around white people too much, that he's lost the sense of his own blackness. The Newark Academy, now Brandeis, and always everyone's darling, the white people's darling. Too gentle and accommodating, they say, no chip on his shoulder. And yet, at the same time, they're so proud of him and so grateful to the Waxmans for helping them out. It's a complicated world, isn't it, Archie? And how do you feel about all this?" "My mind is still open. I won't know what I think until I've had a chance to meet Luther. Tell Amy to call me, okay?" "I will. And don't worry. Luther's a good guy. And tell Edna Waxman to tell the Bonds not to worry either. Their son does have a chip on his shoulder. It's just not a big one, that's all. Length of chip, I'd say. A chip that suits him well." 1 month and 1 week later, Ferguson, Mary Donahue, Amy, and Luther were on their way north in the old Pontiac, heading for the farm in southern Vermont where Howard Small was spending the summer. And on that same Friday in another car, Ferguson's mother and Amy's father, along with Ferguson's aunt and step-uncle, were heading toward Williamstown, Massachusetts, where the five undergraduates would be joining up with them the following evening to watch Noah perform as Lucky in Waiting for Godot. Pigs and cows and chickens, the stench of manure in the barn, wind rushing down the green hills and swirling through the valley below, and broad-shouldered Howard tramping beside the New York foursome as they toured the grounds of his aunt and uncle's 60-acre spread on the outskirts of Newfane. How happy Ferguson was to see his college pal again, and how good it was that the aunt and uncle had no prissy qualms about the co-ed sleeping arrangements. Howard had put his foot down and forced them to accept, or else. And now that the business between Amy and her father concerning Luther had been resolved, how relaxed everyone was that weekend, far from the hot cement and steaming fumes of New York, as Amy galloped around a meadow on a chestnut stallion, a memorable image that Ferguson would go on savoring for years afterward. But nothing was more memorable than the performance on Saturday night in Williamstown, just 50 miles from the farm, the play that Ferguson had read in high school but had never seen mounted on stage, which he had reread earlier that week to prepare himself for the production. But nothing, as it turned out, could have prepared him for what he saw that night. Noah, with his wig of long white hair hanging under his bowler hat, and the rope around his neck, the abused slave and bearer of burdens, the dunce, the mute clown who falls and totters and stumbles, such finely choreographed steps, the shuffling, torporous, snap-to surges forward and back, dozing off on his feet, the unexpected kick delivered to Estragon's leg, the unexpected tears that fall down his face, the contorted, pathetic dance he does when ordered to dance, the whip, and the bags up and the bags down, again and again, Pozzo's stool folded and unfolded again and again. It didn't seem credible that Noah could do such things. And then, in the first act, the famous speech, the Puncher and Wattman speech, the qua, 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 qua speech, the long harangue of unpunctuated scholarly gibberish. And Noah flew into it as if in a trance, such an impossible display of breath control and complex verbal rhythm. And Jesus Christ, Ferguson said to himself, Jesus fucking Christ, as the words flew out of his cousin's mouth. And then the other three on stage jumped him and pounded him and smashed his hat, and Pozzo brandished the whip again, and once again it was, up, pig, and off they went, exiting the stage as Lucky crashed in the wings. After the bows and the applause, Ferguson took Noah in his arms and embraced him so tightly that he almost broke his ribs. Once Noah was able to breathe again, he said, I'm glad you liked it, Archie, but I think I've done a better job in most of the other performances. Knowing you're in the audience, and my father, and Mildred, and Amy, and your mother, well, you get the idea. Pressure, man. Real pressure. The New York quartet drove back to the city on Sunday night, and the next morning, July 25th, the poet Frank O'Hara was struck by a dune buggy on a Fire Island beach and killed at the age of 40. As word of the accident spread among the writers, painters, and musicians of New York, a great lamentation rose up throughout the city, and one by one the young downtown poet who had worshipped O'Hara broke down and wept. Ron Pearson wept, Ann Wexler wept, Louis Tarkowski wept, and uptown on East 89th Street, Billy Best punched the wall so hard that his fist went straight through the sheetrock. Ferguson had never met O'Hara, but he knew his work and admired it for its effervescence and freedom. And though he didn't break down or put his fist through a wall, he spent the next day rereading the two books of O'Hara's that he owned, Lunch Poems and Meditations in an Emergency. I am the least difficult of men, O'Hara had written in 1954. All I want is boundless love. True to her word, Celia sent Ferguson precisely 24 letters during her 2 months of travel abroad. Good letters, he felt, well-written letters, with many observant remarks about her experiences in Dublin, Cork, London, Paris, Nice, Florence, and Rome. For not unlike her brother, Artie, Celia knew how to look at things carefully, with more patience and curiosity than most people did, as displayed in this sentence about the Irish countryside in one of her early letters, which set the tone for everything that followed. a green, treeless land dotted with gray stones and black rooks flying overhead, a stillness in the heart of all things, even when the heart is beating and the wind has begun to blow. Not bad for a future biologist, Ferguson thought, but friendly as the letters were, there was nothing intimate or revealing about them. And when Celia returned to New York on August 23rd, one day after Mary Donahue kissed him goodbye and returned to Ann Arbor, Ferguson had no idea where he stood with her. He meant to find out as quickly as possible, however. For now that Celia was 17 and a half, the ban against physical contact had been lifted. Love was a contact sport, after all. And Ferguson was looking for love now. He was ready for love, to use the words from the old number in Singing in the Rain. And for all the old reasons and all the new ones as well, he was hoping to find that love in the arms of Celia Fetterman, if she would have him. She was dumbfounded by the bareness of his apartment when she came to visit on the 27th. The desk was fine, the mattress was fine, but how could he keep his clothes in a cardboard box in the closet and not have a bag or a basket for dirty laundry and just throw his socks and undies on the bathroom floor? And why not get a bookcase instead of piling up books against the wall? And why no pictures? And why eat at his desk when there was room for a small kitchen table in the corner? Because he wanted as few things as possible, Ferguson said, and because he didn't care. Yes, yes, Celia said. She was acting like a middle-aged woman from the suburbs, and he was roughing it as a bohemian renegade in the jungles of Manhattan. She got all that, and it wasn't her concern, but didn't he want to make it just a little bit nicer? They were standing in the middle of the room with sunlight pouring in on them, sunlight pouring in through the windows and onto Celia's face, the illuminated face of a 17-and-a-half-year-old girl, of such beauty that Ferguson was stunned by the sight of her, stunned into silence and awe and trembling uncertainty. And as he went on looking at her, looking and looking at her because he was unable to look at anything else, Celia smiled and said, "What's wrong, Archie? Why are you staring at me like that?" "I'm sorry," he said. "I can't help it. It's just that you're so beautiful, Celia, so astonishingly beautiful. I'm beginning to wonder if you're real." Celia laughed. "Don't be absurd," she said. "I'm not even pretty, just your average workaday girl." "Who's been feeding you that crap? You're a goddess, the queen of all earth and every city in heaven." "Well, it's nice that you think so, but maybe you should have your eyes checked, Archie, and get a pair of glasses." The sun shifted in the sky, or a cloud passed in front of it, or Ferguson was beginning to feel embarrassed by his gushing pronouncement. But 4 seconds after Celia said those words, the subject of her looks was no longer on the table. The subject was once again the table Ferguson didn't have, the bookcase he didn't have, the bureau he didn't have. And if it meant so much to her, he said, maybe they could borrow Billy's hand truck and go out looking for furniture on the streets. It was the tried-and-true method of decorating apartments in Manhattan, and with the rich people on the Upper East Side throwing out good stuff every day, all they had to do was walk a few blocks south and a few blocks west, where they were bound to find something on the sidewalk that would meet with her approval. "I'm game if you are," Celia said. Ferguson was game, but before they left, there were a couple of things he wanted to show her, and then he led Celia over to his desk, where he pointed to a small wooden box with the words Fetterman's Travels written on it. And once she had absorbed the significance of that box and the loyalty to their friendship it demonstrated, Ferguson opened the bottom right-hand drawer of the desk, pulled out a copy of the Gizmo Press edition of Mulligan's Travels, and handed it to her. "Your book," Celia said. "It's been published." She looked down at Howard's cover, ran her hand softly over the drawing of Mulligan, thumbed briefly through the mimeographed pages inside, and then, inexplicably, let the book drop to the floor. "Why did you do that?" Ferguson asked. "Because I want to kiss you," she said. A moment later, she put her arms around him and pressed her mouth against his, and all at once his arms were around her, and their tongues were inside each other's mouths. It was their first kiss, and it was a real kiss, which gladdened Ferguson's heart greatly. For not only did the kiss offer the promise of more kisses in the days ahead, it proved that Celia was in fact real. There had been no contact with his father in over a year. Ferguson rarely thought about him now, and whenever he did, he noticed that the rage he had once felt against him had subsided into a dull indifference, or perhaps into nothing, a blank in his head. He had no father. The man who had once been married to his mother had vanished into the shadows of an alternate world that no longer intersected with the world his son lived in. And if the man was not yet certifiably dead, he had gone missing a long time ago and would never be found at any time in the future. 3 days before he left for Princeton to begin his sophomore year, however, as Ferguson sat in the living room of the house on Woodhull Crescent, watching a Mets game with his stepbrother Jim and Jim's fiancée, Nancy, the prophet of prophets unexpectedly jumped onto the TV screen in a between-innings commercial. Sporting thick sideburns with a touch of gray in them and decked out in a natty, fashionable suit, color unknown since it was a black-and-white TV, he was announcing the opening of a new Ferguson's outlet in Florham Park and hammering away at the low prices, the low, low prices you can afford. And come on over and check out the new RCA color televisions and the stupefying bargains that would be available next weekend when the store opened for business. How deftly and confidently he was making his pitch, Ferguson said to himself, assuring the audience how much their anguished, monotone lives would be enhanced by shopping at Ferguson's. And for a man who had never learned how to talk, as his mother had once put it, he was doing a hell of a good job of talking now. And how relaxed and comfortable he looked in front of the camera, how pleased with himself, how perfectly in charge of the moment. And as he waved his arm and smiled, gesturing to the invisible masses to come on in and save a bundle, a quartet of unaccompanied soprano and tenor voices trilled brightly in the background. Prices never lower, spirits never higher, at Ferguson's, Ferguson's, Ferguson's. Two thoughts appeared in Ferguson's mind after the commercial ended, the one forming so quickly after the other that they were almost simultaneous. One, that he should stop watching baseball games on television. And two, that his father was still hovering around the edges of his life, not yet fully effaced, still there in spite of the distance between them. And perhaps another chapter of the story still had to be written before the book could finally be closed. Unless he took a crash course in ancient Greek and learned the language in a single academic year, there would be no more classes with Nagel. But Nagel was still his faculty advisor, and for reasons that had everything to do with his father, or perhaps nothing to do with his father, Ferguson continued to look to Nagel for validation and encouragement, wanting to impress the older man by doing top-quality work in his courses, by exhibiting proof of the soundness of character demanded from the participants in the Walt Whitman Scholars Program, but most of all by winning the professor's support for the fiction he was writing, a sign that he was fulfilling the promise Nagel had seen in him after reading 11 Moments from the Life of Gregor Flamm. At their first one-on-one conference of the fall semester, Ferguson handed Nagel a copy of the Gizmo Press edition of Mulligan's Travels. Ambivalent and fearful that he had jumped into publishing his work too soon, worried that Nagel would regard the Mimeo book as the overly ambitious act of a young writer who wasn't ready to be published, doubly worried that Nagel would read the book and find it awful, delivering another one of the punches Ferguson dreaded so much, even as he longed for kisses from the people he admired. But Nagel accepted the book that first afternoon with a friendly nod and a few words of congratulations, knowing nothing about the contents, of course, but at least not condemning Ferguson for having rushed into premature publication and the inevitable regret and embarrassment that would follow from such an ill-conceived show of arrogance. And as Nagel held the book in his hands and studied the black-and-white illustration on the cover, he mentioned how good he thought the drawing was. "Who's H.S.?" he asked, pointing to the abbreviated signature in the lower right-hand corner. And when Ferguson said it was Howard Small, his Princeton roommate, Nagel's dour mien sent forth one of its unaccustomed smiles. "Hard-working Howard Small," he said. "Such a good student, but I had no idea he could draw so well. You boys are quite a pair, aren't you?" At their next sit-down in the professor's office 3 days later, when they were supposed to decide which courses Ferguson would be taking that semester, Nagel began by pronouncing his verdict on Mulligan's travels. It didn't matter that Billy, Ron, and Noah had all warmly embraced the book. Nor did it matter that Amy, Luther, and Celia had responded with enthusiastic kisses. In Celia's case, genuine physical kisses. And forget that Uncle Don and Aunt Mildred had taken the trouble to call on the phone and shower him with flattering comments for close to an hour, or that Dan and his mother and the departed Evie Monroe and the departed Mary Donahue had all told him how good they thought it was. Nagel's opinion was the one that counted most, because he was the only objective observer, the only one not tied to Ferguson by friendship or love or familial bonds, and a negative word from him would undercut and perhaps even demolish the accumulated positive words from the others. "Not bad," he said, using the phrase he tended to fall back on when he liked something rather well, but with certain reservations. "An advance from your previous work," he continued, tautly written, a fine and subtle music in the sentences, absorbing to read, but stark, raving mad, of course, an inventiveness bordering on mental breakdown territory. And yet, for all that, the texts are funny when you mean for them to be funny, dramatic when you mean for them to be dramatic. And clearly you've read Borges by now and have learned some lessons from him about how to walk the line between what I would call fiction and speculative prose. Some silly, sophomoric ideas, I'm afraid. But that's what you are, Ferguson, a sophomore, so we won't dwell on the book's weaknesses. If nothing else, you've convinced me you're making progress, which suggests you're going to continue to make more progress as time goes on. "Thank you," Ferguson said. "I scarcely know what to say." "Don't turn mute on me now, Ferguson. We still have to discuss your plans for the semester, which brings me to the question I've been meaning to ask you. Have you changed your mind about registering for one of the creative writing workshops?" "No, not really." "It's a good program, you know, one of the best anywhere." "I'm sure you're right. I just feel I'll be happier gutting it out on my own." "I understand your reservations, but at the same time, I think it would help you. And then there's the matter of Princeton, of being a part of the Princeton community. Why, for example, haven't you submitted any of your work to the Nassau Literary Review?" "I don't know. It never occurred to me." "Do you have anything against Princeton?" "No, not at all. I love it here." "No second thoughts, then?" "None whatsoever. I feel blessed." As he went on talking to Nagel, and the two of them mapped out his curriculum for the fall, Howard was in their dorm room reading The Scarlet Notebook, which Ferguson had pronounced DOA 1 week earlier. "Yet another corpse expelled from my shit-infested brain," as he had said to Howard when he handed him the manuscript. But Howard was used to Ferguson's torments and self-doubts by then, and paid them no heed, confident in the strength of his own intelligence to draw his own independent conclusions. And by the time Ferguson walked into the room after his conference with Nagel, Howard had finished the book. "Archie," he said, "have you ever read Wittgenstein?" "No, not yet. He's one of many on my not-yet list." "Good, or rather get a load of this, mein Herr." Howard picked up a blue book with Wittgenstein's name on the cover, opened it to whatever page he was looking for, and read out loud to Ferguson, quote, "And it also means something to talk about living in the pages of a book." How true," Ferguson said, and then, bringing himself to attention and giving a stiff military salute, he added, "Thank you, Ludwig." "You see where I'm going with this, don't you?" "Not really." "The Scarlet Notebook. I just finished reading it about 10 minutes ago. How I spent my summer vacation. Remember those things we had to write as kids? Well, that's how I spent my summer vacation, living in the pages of that monstrosity, that abortion of a book. You know how much I loved Mulligan, right? This one is deeper and better and more original, a breakthrough, and I hope to God you let me do the cover for it." "What makes you think Billy will want to publish it?" "Don't be an idiot. Of course he'll want to publish it. Billy discovered you, and he thinks you're a genius, his bright-eyed baby genius, and wherever you go, that's where he'll want to go to." "Now you tell me," Ferguson said, beginning to crack a smile. "I just got the lowdown on Mulligan from Nagel. Good and not good, sophomoric but fun, written by a madman who should be put in a straitjacket, a step forward but still a long way to go. I happen to agree with him. You shouldn't listen to Nagel, Archie. He's a brilliant professor of Greek. We both love him, but he isn't qualified to judge your work. He's stuck back there, and you're what's going to happen next. Not tomorrow, maybe, but definitely the day after tomorrow. So began Ferguson's second year in Black Squirrel Heaven, with a pep talk from his roommate Howard Small, who was just as important a friend to him now as Noah and Jim were, an indispensable part of what was keeping him alive. And however exaggerated Howard's comments about his work might have been, he was correct to assume that Billy would want to publish his new book. And because Joanna was 7.5 months pregnant and too close to having her baby to type up the stencils, Billy did the job himself, so that 1 week before little Molly Best came into the world on November 9th, Ferguson's second little book was in print. It was a better year than the first one had been, with fewer anxieties and inner stumbles, with a more solid sense of belonging to the place where fortune had willed him to be. The year of Anglo-Saxon poems and Chaucer, and the gorgeous, alliterative verses of Sir Thomas Wyatt, "As she fleeth afore, fainting I follow." The year of protesting the Vietnam War by joining in the demonstrations against Dow Chemical at the engineering quad with Howard and his other friends from the Woodrow Wilson Club to denounce the manufacturer of napalm. Of settling into his more amply decorated New York weekend apartment and strengthening his friendships with Billy, Joanna, Ron, and Bo Janard. Of appearing as an extra in Noah's first film, a 7-minute short entitled Manhattan Confidential, in which Ferguson could be glimpsed at a back table in a low-life bar, reading Spinoza in French, and the year of working on The Souls of Inanimate Things, a sequence of 13 meditations on the objects in his apartment that he finished at the end of May. It was also the year when his grandfather died of the strange and ignominious death that no one in the family wanted to talk about, the culmination of a week-long gambling binge in Las Vegas, during which he lost over $90,000 at roulette, and then suffered a heart attack while making love, or trying to make love, to 2 20-year-old hookers in his room. In the 17 months since his wife's death, Benji Adler had blown more than $350,000 and was put in his grave as a pauper by the Jewish Burial Society, run by the Workmen's Circle, an organization he had joined in 1936, back in the days when he had been reading the novels of Jack London and still thought of himself as a socialist. Then there was Celia. First and last, there was Celia, for that was the year when Ferguson fell in love. And the most perplexing thing about it was that no one but his mother saw in her what he did. Rose judged her to be a magnificent girl, but all the others were confused. Noah called her a gawky stock from Westchester, the female version of her ghosty boy brother, but with darker skin and a more attractive face, a Barnard geek who would spend her life in a white lab coat studying rats. Jim thought she was good-looking but too young for Ferguson, not yet fully evolved. Howard admired her intelligence, but wondered if she wasn't too conventional for Ferguson, a bourgeois goody-good who would never understand how little he cared about what everyone else seemed to care about. Amy weighed in with a single word, "Why?" Luther called her a work in progress, and Billy said, "Archie, what are you doing?" Did he know what he was doing? He thought he did. He had thought so when Celia put down the dollar bill in front of the old man at Horn and Hardart's. He had thought so when she insisted on no more fake brother stuff while walking from Grand Central to the automat. And he had thought so when she dropped his book to the floor and declared she wanted to kiss him. How many kisses had followed that first kiss over the ensuing months? Hundreds of them, thousands of them. And the unexpected discovery on the night of October 22nd, when they lowered themselves onto the mattress in Ferguson's room and made love for the first time, that Celia was no longer a virgin. There had been the aforementioned Bruce in the spring of her last year of high school, and there had been 2 American travelers on her tour of Europe with her cousin Emily, an Ohioan in Cork and a California boy in Paris. But rather than feel disappointed by the knowledge that he wasn't her first one, Ferguson was heartened by it, encouraged that she was adventurous and open and had a carnal appetite strong enough to push her into taking risks. He loved her body. He found her naked body so beautiful that he could barely speak the first time she took off her clothes and lay down beside him. The impossible smoothness and warmth of her skin, her slender arms and legs, the curving cheeks of her round, clutchable ass, her small, upright breasts and dark, pointed nipples. He had never known anyone as beautiful as she was. And what the others couldn't understand was how happy it made him to be with her, to run his hands over the body of the person he now loved more than any person he had ever loved. If the others couldn't get that, too bad for them. But Ferguson wasn't about to ask the minstrel boys to unpack their violins and lay it on thick with the schmaltz. One violin was enough, and as long as Ferguson could hear the music it was playing, he would go on listening to it by himself. More important than the others, or what the others thought, was the simple fact of the two of them. And now that they had advanced to the next stage, there was the ever more urgent need to understand precisely what was going on. Was his burgeoning love for Celia still connected to Artie's death, he asked himself, or had her brother finally been dropped from the equation? That was how it had started, after all, back in the days of the New Rochelle dinners, when the world had split in half, and the arithmetic of the gods had provided him with a formula to glue it together again. Fall in love with his dead friend's sister, and henceforth the earth would continue to revolve around the sun. The mad calculations of an overheated adolescent mind, of an angry, grieving mind. But however irrational the numbers might have been, he had hoped he would eventually fall for her. And if and when he did, he had also hoped she would fall for him. And now that both of those things had happened, he didn't want Artie to be involved in it anymore. For the things that had happened had mostly happened on their own, starting with the day in New York, when he saw a compassionate girl pull a dollar from her purse and give it to a broken-down old man, with that same girl 1 year later, standing in the light of his apartment and overpowering him with the force of her beauty, with 24 letters from foreign countries stashed away in a wooden box, with an excited girl dropping his book to the floor and wanting to kiss him, none of which had anything to do with Artie. And yet now that he and Celia had fallen for each other, Ferguson had to admit that it felt good and right that she was the one he was with and no one else, even if something in him cringed at the thought of that good and right. Because now that he loved Celia, he understood how sick his desire for her had been in the first place, to look upon a living, breathing person and turn her into a symbol of his campaign to rectify the injustices of the world. What had he been thinking, for God's sake? And how much better it would be if Artie were out of it for good now. No more ghosts, Ferguson said to himself. The dead boy had brought him together with Celia, but now that he had done his job, it was time for him to go away. Never a word to her about any of that, and as 1966 turned into 1967, it was remarkable how little they talked about her brother, how determined they both were to avoid the subject and get on with the business of being just two, so the invisible third would not be standing between them or floating above them. And as the months rolled on, and their connection tightened, and Ferguson's friends gradually came around and began to accept her as a permanent part of the landscape, he realized there was one necessary act still in front of him before the spell could be broken. It was spring by then, and having celebrated their double March birthdays on the 3rd and 6th of the month, they were now 20 and 18 years old. And one Saturday afternoon in the middle of May, 1 week after Ferguson had written the final paragraph of The Souls of Inanimate Things, he traveled across town to Morningside Heights, where Celia was ensconced in her dormitory room at Brooks Hall, working on 2 end-of-the-year term papers, which meant that weekend would be different from most other weekends. It would not include their customary walks and talks and nighttime explorations in Ferguson's bed. But he had called Celia at 10 o'clock that morning and asked if he could borrow her for 30 or 40 minutes later in the day. And no, he said, not for that, although he dearly wished it could be that, but rather to do something for him that would be both simple and unstrenuous and yet, at the same time, of utmost importance to their future happiness together. When she asked him what that thing was, he said he would tell her later. "Why so mysterious, Archie?" "Because," he said, "just because, that's why." As he traveled along the edge of Central Park on the crosstown bus, his right hand was in the pocket of his spring jacket, and the fingers of that hand were wrapped around a pink rubber ball, which he had bought that morning at a candy and cigarette store on First Avenue. A commonplace pink rubber ball, manufactured by the Spalding Company and widely referred to in New York as a Spaldine. That was Ferguson's mission on that bright afternoon in the middle of May, to walk into Riverside Park with Celia and have a catch with her, to renounce the vow he had taken in the silent depths of his misery 6 years ago and have done with his obsession at last. Celia smiled when he told her what the thing of utmost importance was, giving him a look that seemed to suggest she knew he was playing a joke or had something up his sleeve and was still hiding it from her. But she was happy to be liberated from her room, she said, and what better way to pass the time than by having a catch in the park? Celia was doubly up for it because she was an athletic girl, an excellent swimmer, a decent tennis player, and a not bad shooter of baskets. And having observed her on the tennis court a couple of times, Ferguson knew she could catch a ball and didn't throw the way girls usually did, with the arm crooked at the elbow, but more or less as boys did, with a thrust from the shoulder of a fully extended arm. He pressed his lips against her face and thanked her for coming along. No matter how much he might have wanted to, he could never tell her why they were doing this. As they headed for the park, mysterious bursts of sweat began spilling from Ferguson's pores. His stomach began to throb, and it was becoming more and more difficult to fill his lungs with air. Dizzy, so dizzy that he took hold of Celia's arm to maintain his balance as they walked down the sharp incline of West 116th Street and shuffled toward Riverside Drive. Dizzy and scared. He had made the promise to himself when he was still a boy, and since then it had been one of the burning forces in his life, a test of will and inner strength and sacrifice to a holy cause, solidarity across the chasm between the living and the dead, honoring the dead by saying no to something beautiful from this world. And to break that promise now wasn't easy for him. It was hard, harder than anything he could think of. But it had to be done. Had to be done now. For noble as his sacrifice had been, it had also been crazy. And he didn't want to be crazy anymore. They crossed Riverside Drive, and once their feet were touching the grass in the park, Ferguson took the ball out of his pocket. "Back up a little bit, Celia," he said to her, and after the smiling Celia had bounced back until they were standing about 12 feet apart, Ferguson raised his arm and threw her the ball.